Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Project Scars podcast. My name is Seth Miersma, one of your three hosts today. Joining me, as has been the case for all four podcasts so far, Mr. Kyle Hyatt.
Yellow.
Mr. Brett Evans.
Howdy, howdy.
And we're excited to talk to you about new cars, old cars, fun cars, ruined cars, fast cars. I don't know if we have any slow cars today, but every kind of car imaginable. Before we do that, I want to talk to you about the Project Scars podcast, which is presented to you by CarID.com. Fix it, upgrade it, customize it. CarID.com is your car parts destination. And it's also brought to you today by the CarID Drive blog, where you can find amazing stories about cars, owners, incredible builds, unbelievable driving adventures, and get inspired for your next automotive project. What a seamless segue into that intro. What do you think?
I mean, crushed it.
Unbelievable.
Well done, me. Yeah.
Best it's ever been.
Teflon Don over here.
So let's see. Do we have anything to catch up on before we launch into the actual pod, the car talk? You guys do anything interesting this past week, this weekend?
I mean, it's not cars. I bought a bicycle for the first time in like seven eons.
Solid.
Yeah, I can go ride my bicycle with my wife, who has an e-bike, and so she'll like totally smoke me at any and all times, but I'm excited. It'll be fun.
That's nice. What kind of bike did you get?
It's a 1994 Klein Fervor, which is I hate the word fervor, but
Fervor.
It's like the rural juror.
Rural juror, I was just going to say.
Yeah, but it's cool. Like, I've never had a mountain bike. I've never had an aluminum frame bike. So we're trying new things. We're blazing trails. Figuratively, not literally, because if I take this thing off road, I will die.
Yeah.
You'll get there.
Please don't die. Have you done anything to it, or was it basically ready to rock when you bought it?
So I bought it from the original owner, which is weird and rad. Like, I saw like the receipt for it from the bike shop in Santa Monica from 1994, and I was like, can I keep that? He's like, it's got my address on it. I'm like, I'm at your house, dude. Like, but he gave me the original owner's manual for the bike, which I've never seen before. I didn't know the bikes came with owner's manuals, but indeed they do.
That's cool.
Yeah, but everything was like, the tires were like basically falling apart because they'd been sitting in a Southern California garage for 30 years.
This is a really amusing, like, the parallels to classic car ownership are very amusing to me right now. Original owner's manual, original build sheet, original, like, it's very, I like this a lot.
Numbers He's matching,
still in the
though.
Same house. He's still in the same address since 1994. That's incredible, too.
I wish I could accurately describe to you what this guy looks like, but yeah, no, he's definitely dying in that house and probably isn't going to get found for a while.
Let's... Like, maybe tomorrow or the next day?
It could happen. You know, I don't want to, I'm not trying to wish ill of the of Alan, but I don't think Alan's thriving like emotionally. So,
okay.
You know, all right. Send out the vibes.
Shout out to Alan. Good job keeping your bike in reasonable condition so that Kyle and his wife can enjoy it together on their rides. I had
innovation class.
I had a contemporary bike was my first really good new bike, Kyle, was an aluminum framed Raleigh. I forget the actual model now, but it was their like mainline mountain bike. That was my graduation present. I graduated in 1996, so I bought it probably in like early 1996. And that thing, like, I rode it all over the like really sandy trails around Western Michigan. Like, did dune riding and stuff on it. It was totally rigid, like rigid forks. Mm-hmm. No,
yeah, this came with a suspension fork, but I'm ditching it because I hate them.
I never needed it. I wasn't anywhere like with enough like up or down for it really to matter or wasn't rocky enough, but I thought that thing was a rocket ship when I first got it because I just was on old steel frame, crappy bikes with bad components, and it was incredible.
In my early to mid 20s, I lived in Portland, Oregon, as one does. Mm-hmm. At that age, and I bicycled everywhere. I didn't have a car for like 4 years. And so I just ripped around town on like a fixed gear and then a single speed, kind of when those were starting to get popular. And so much fun. It was so cool. Like, I loved it so much, and I really missed it. So now that I'm like older and fatter and like tireder, we'll see how it goes. But, you know, what are you going to do? Just got to try. Got to try something. Got to be physically fit to get in the pit, boys. So.
I remember when I was like 7 or 8, I had the crappiest, it was a Roadmaster mountain bike, and it was an absolute pile of junk. And my brother had a Schwinn, whatever their hard, their rigid mountain bike was. Mm-hmm. And I remember I did a car and driver's style comparison where I like took photos and I stapled the photos to sheets of paper, and I had like highs, lows, and verdicts for both of them. It was a lot of fun.
You were the kid that knew exactly what you wanted to do from the moment you were out of the womb, right, Brett?
Oh, yeah. 100%. Absolutely. Yeah. Peter Egan was my, like, bedtime stories. We read Peter Egan for bedtime stories.
He's such a cool guy. I met him a couple of years ago at the Quail Motorcycle Gathering. Super, super interesting dude. No.
I want to meet him so bad.
Heard him in Redding, but I've never met him that I recall anyways. But, yeah, one car related, to bring us back to four wheels and automotive, footnote to the Raleigh that I had, was it, I brought it to college, and you know, I rode it around, like stayed in my apartments and stuff, but then died an incredibly tragic death in the trunk of a 1984 or 85 Chevy Cavalier Eurosport, self-inflicted wound. I won't name names. A good friend of mine and I were trying to drive the car backwards in preparation for a stunt that we were trying to undertake. Lost control of the car, hit a tree, and just like made a wedge-shaped dent in the middle of the trunk that I assume cut the bike in half. The trunk was inaccessible, and clearly we were going to leave it so that the police wouldn't find out who did what we did.
Trying to learn how to Rockford or something?
We were going to jump the Eurosport backwards off a ramp.
Sick.
But unfortunately, we crashed it first. So probably that was somebody looking out for me. Is that was that the last time an angel touched me on the shoulder and said, it's happening to you this week?
So it's really strong, like, you want to get lit and jump off the roof of my house energy.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, but in a car.
Perfect.
It's perfect. Lots of that. Right on. So, yeah, well, and I guess that's a decent segue, because that was, in fact, one of the first project cars. That we'll have to hit that chapter. There's a whole chapter called Car Magnum in my automotive upbringing that we'll get to at some point. But we also, of course, want to talk about the project cars that we're working on right now. And in fact, that's sort of the focus of this episode for those of you listening, watching at home. We've talked already a little bit about, I think all of us had, about cars that we own and that we're working on and that we're driving and stuff. So we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been driving this week. For me, it's one and the same with the project car. And then I think we're going to move in and talk about kind of our ideal versions of project cars and things like that. So as you guys are watching at home, if you're interested in any of the models or any of the modifications or ideas that we're talking about, please, by all means, drop us a comment, ask us a question. You can do that wherever you're watching this, whether it's on YouTube or on X or Facebook or wherever. Just leave a comment, we'll throw it up on the screen, and we'll involve you in the conversation. So Brett, why don't we start with you? What have you been driving this week, rather?
This week I just got out of the Volkswagen ID4, which is a perfectly cromulent electric SUV, does the job just fine. And it was not bad. Let me show you some pictures of it real quickly.
It is, as our common friend Stephen Ewing used to say, a car.
It is exactly one unit of electric car. The best thing about it is the play and pause button or logos on the pedals. Like,
I didn't even notice those. I forgot to look for those. That's a shame on my part. I will say, so the one thing this car does absolutely terribly that I cannot forgive it for is it has the weirdest ride. It like rides so rough and so harsh over like little city bumps, but then once you go through dips and stuff like that, the bottom end completely like, or the rear end completely bottoms out, and you're like, I was telling Noah that like it will drive me to have poor posture, because if I sit normally with my head kind of up against the head restraint, my head is like rocking back and forth the whole time. It was terrible. Otherwise it was not bad, you know, like the interior is comfortable. They did some updates to the infotainment that make it a little bit better, which is nice. This was the Pro S rear wheel drive. So this is the longest range variant, has, 227 horsepower, I think. And it was fine. It was totally, totally adequate. And then I did a solid, like 280 miles with, 20% left in the battery.
Cool.
So yeah, it was perfect. It was a completely adequate vehicle. I kind of think the way the thing looks is pretty charming. I think it's really appealing in a lot of ways. I love this color. This like little like moonbeam blue color is gorgeous. So yeah, I got nothing against it. Definitely, probably not the one that I'd pick unless it was a screaming deal. But you know, just fine for the people who buy them.
I think the advantage of the ID4. So I have a at least one close friend who owns an ID4 after having. I believe he had a Jetta Sport Wagon for a while. And was really excited about buying an EV and looked at a lot of different stuff and got into this. One advantage is, and I'm not even saying this cynically at all, but like you can buy them, right? Like they're available. He was able to go test drive the car and buy it, as opposed to, I think he might've also been shopping for Mach-E. Don't hold me to this, cause I don't remember the story exactly, but I know that there were another like two models. Maybe it was one of the Koreans that he was looking for, that he just couldn't find one. He's in Austin. So I think there's a higher than normal demand. You guys probably have the same thing in Southern California. Lots of people are buying EVs. Like the newer, more desirable models, I think, are more difficult to find or marked up, or you're just really looking at high end trims. ID4 in my mind is, cause I think we all probably agree, like it's not our favorite EV based on like the specs and the driving characteristics and that kind of thing. But a lot of people can afford it. I think it does suit the needs of lots of drivers. If you are really looking to have, to buy an electric vehicle, and they're not, as far as I know, like aren't experiencing the same sort of like big markups. In fact, I think that he might have been able to get a deal on it in and around Austin, which is pretty cool. So,
well, and I will say the first time I drove the ID4, it was like the pre-update one, like the very first models, and it truly wasn't impressive in any way. The range wasn't great. The charging rate was like barely adequate. This one's a lot better in that respect. I charged it at a 350 kilowatt station. And it hit a peak of like 182 kilowatts. It went from 20 to 85% in literally 25 minutes, which is just thoroughly not bad for a public charging station situation. So I honestly was pretty impressed with that aspect of it. I had to wait a while to plug in, but that's a problem for a different time.
Right. Yeah, that's a nightmare. That's the thing I hate too, is waiting to find a charger, especially Electrify America.
It's, again, problem for another time, but there's a lot of vandalism going on in Los Angeles around these chargers. And so all of my normal chargers are now disabled because they've been like vandalized and stripped for copper and stuff like that. So,
oh no.
It was only a matter of time before somebody went full on like bubbles in the wire on them. Let's be honest. Like,
yep.
There are quite a few EVs in my neighborhood that I see parked or see driving around or something. And I don't have a charger set up in my garage yet. My garage is 100 years old and it needs to be, has to have new power lines run out there before I can do any of that. So I charge down the street. A block and a half away, there's a parking structure close to the University of Michigan campus that has very slow 6 kilowatt chargers. But they're basically, it's free on the weekends, free to park. And then I'm paying not very much money to plug in a car, which is great for me. I just discovered that there's some outdoor tennis courts, basically the same distance in the opposite direction from me at a park. And they put in like 6 chargers with big solar panels next to, fed by solar panels too. So I'm happy to see, I'm not trying to stick it to you guys in LA or anything like that, but like, it's awesome here where even there's a fair number of people who are leveraging them. I think more people also probably have in-home charging because there are a lot of garages in my neighborhood. But there's almost always, you know, 50% of the chargers available in one of those two locations from what I've seen, which is great.
I've got a handful of 9.6 kilowatt chargers in my neighborhood, just like street side. And I've used them before and it's not bad at all if that's your solution. The other thing that I usually do whenever I have an electric car is I just plug it into a 110 every night, knowing full well that it's not going to fully charge, but it's going to give me the 30 or 40 miles that I need for the next day. Holy beetle. Sorry about that. This time I didn't do that. I was like, I'm not going to use the street side ones. I'm not going to use my garage. I'm just going to try the public high-speed charging just to see what it's like. And it wasn't great. You know, there's still a ways to go, but we'll get there. And I will say this, when I do plug in at home, like I'm lucky because I have a place to plug in at home, but even just that 110, it's perfect for, you know, daily driving. You know, it won't get me that full 200 miles, but it'll get me enough for the next day of driving. And so I kind of think that some of the like hype around charging is a little overblown, because most people can still do their daily commutes in an electric car, even if they don't have charging, high-speed charging at home.
Yep. Lots of solutions. Agreed. All right, Kyle, how about you? You were in the same corporate family, but a slightly more exciting side of it this week.
Yeah. This is actually, well, it's not for car ID, which is the thing, which is weird. I have other clients. But I'm in the brand spanking new Porsche Panamera. And weirdly, the one that I have is like this exact same spec. It's the base model in, it was like Volcano Gray or something. Just super, like, as Porsche does this thing with their press fleet where, like, you know, most manufacturers will do like every option in the book, crazy expensive, top trim, blah, blah, blah. And they'll, like, you know, send those out because they're the most impressed or whatever. Porsche will do that. And then they'll also just send out like the most basic base models with like hardly any options, which I love. I think it's really rad. And this is kind of like that. So, yeah, this thing's awesome. It's so good. It's got air suspension as standard. It's the V6 is fine. It doesn't even sound terrible, which is some kind of miracle. The interior is excellent. The Bose stereo is perfectly serviceable. I think this generation looks great. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they only offered it in the Sport Turismo still, I would have zero complaints, but no, it's phenomenal. I love the Panamera.
What's the output on the V6 in this?
It's like 360 or 380 okay. or something like that. It's not a ton, but it definitely feels like it'll get out of its own way. The e-hybrid V6 puts out like 500 horsepower or something stupid, and that's actually like that's the way to go. Like spoiler alert, don't buy the base non-hybrid. Like it's the power and economy gains you get from having that PHEV drivetrain is massive, and it's really good. The current generation of like Porsche plug-in hybrids is one of the best, I think, that you can buy in terms of how it's integrated with the gas motor. Mm-hmm. You can do freeway speeds in electric mode for like, and you know, it doesn't care like how fast you're going, and the transitions are really smooth and stuff, but this is good. It's really good.
It's been years, but the last Panamera that I drove out of the press fleet was a base non-S Panamera V6 as well. And I felt roughly, I mean, and so we're talking about like, yeah, around the start of the previous generation, or maybe it was a model year update for the previous generation. And it was such a nice, like relaxed, it was just a great car to like crush highway miles in. If you're commuting in it, you want to have a Porsche and you're not worried about it being kind of 911 bloodthirsty, then it was really, really, you know, like a 7 Series competitor almost, right? Like,
right, right. But I mean, like this actually had like the way that they've set up the chassis and stuff, and this is true of the last generation as well, is like they're like legitimately sporty, even in like the tamest versions. Like the steering is sharp, like the chassis responds really well. Like this thing even stepped out on me a little bit when I just like matted it pulling away from a stop, and that's awesome. Like it's really cool.
That's what it's such a like trope, but that's just something that Porsche does so well. I remember I had a previous generation base Cayenne, and that V6 was terrible. It was so like agricultural and didn't sound good. It was just really dull, and I kind of hated it. And then we went up to we're going to go get lunch at like an old ski lodge. And so we were up in the mountains, and it just was like, the thing came alive. It was so good to drive. It still sounded kind of rough and unappealing, but once you had it in the corners, it was so good. And this was a base, like luxury spec Cayenne V6. And it's just something that Porsche does so well. They make all their cars feel really nice, regardless of the powertrain.
Yeah, chassis and suspension is really amazing. And I do think, I agree, like it's impressive. It's always amazing, of course, when it came in our 911 or Boxster or something, right?
Sure.
When it's a big car, when it's a four-door SUV or you know, even like a Macan or something, and it's making you feel kind of that same way, that blows my mind even more than you expect a 911 to be amazing, right?
Right.
You don't necessarily expect the Panamera to also knock your socks off, so...
Yeah. So I just looked it up. So it's 348 horsepower. It's less than I thought, which is crazy. So just as like a weird sort of parallel, my 21-year-old 911 makes 315 or 320 rated at the crank from a 3.6 liter six-cylinder, and this thing now, you know, 20 years later, with all of the modern technology, doesn't make that much more, but it'll do 0 to 60 in 4.7 seconds, which
that's crazy.
Yeah, which this is a big heavy car. That thing, I mean, it hustles. The thing that's wild though is how expensive the Panamera is relative to like everything else. Like, yeah. Porsche realizes that it's kind of a niche vehicle. Like the audience for a large, fast coupe thing is clearly, you know, pretty narrow. But the base on this one is 102.8, and then if you go to the Panamera 4, which this is $109,800 plus. You know, I think this is pretty low options, but I think it's still like $120,000.
Which, I mean, are there even like a literal hand, like five models, like Porsche models that are under $100,000 at this point?
The only thing that you can do for under $100,000, the Cayenne and Macan, I think you can both still get under $100,000, sure, pretty easily. 911, you can't. 718 is going away soon, I think, but right, you can still get that for under $100,000.
I was surprised though. I was building one the other day, and a 718 with a six cylinder is over $100,000 now. You used to be able to squeak in at 85 or 90, and now it's fully 102 to start. So,
yeah. The base Taycan is 99,400. So yeah, I mean, Porsche is really like, it used to be sort of the like quasi approachable, affordable, like performance brand, but that ship has long sailed. I think they're,
we have to adjust all these, like we have to adjust our brains for inflation too. We talk about this all the time, but of course, like those prices, I haven't done the exercise. Usually when you go through and you do the exercise, like X MSRP today versus even 10 years ago, and then do the same, you know, adjust it for inflation.
Yeah.
It's the same or lower. Right. So it's not like, and then there are lots of cases, I'm not trying to defend like automakers. There are lots of cases where automakers are trying to get as much money as they can out of people too. Certainly Porsche is very, very good at making money, right? Like they're exceptionally great at getting you to spend stupid money on things that you don't necessarily need, but you really, really want to have in your car. I think that's fine. That's always been part of the brand, but yeah, $100,000 is crazy. The first time that 911, the base 911, creeped up over $1,000, I remember, and that was a long time ago now. That sort of blew my mind.
Yeah, I think they can get away with like that sort of stuff, that pricing, and then also like the super a la carte options list, because it's such an aspirational brand. So people are like, I'm buying my first Porsche, or I'm buying a Porsche. I gotta do it right. You know, no one's like specking out a 911 being like, we gotta go basic on this one kind of thing. So like they've really figured it out. They're no amateurs when it comes to making that cashish.
One thing that's crazy too is that like you say this car starts at about $100,000, but then you get into the Turbo S and the Turbo SE hybrid, and you're easily over 200, close to 250, everything like that. There's a lot of technology and a lot of like stuff that goes into making that price higher, but this is still a $100,000 platform. So like the profit margins on those high trims must be insane. Like I can't think of too many automakers that have a literal like 100 to 150% price increase from the base model to the most expensive. And Porsche does that so well. Like the $120,000 911 can very easily become a $400,000 car when you option it the way you want it. It's nuts.
Right. And well, the crazy thing to me about that is that the $250,000 Panamera Turbo E Hybrid doesn't feel like it's based on a $100,000 car. If anything, it's kind of the other way around. Like you feel like you're getting away with something in like the cheaper models. And like the Turbo E Hybrid, like the Panamera and the Cayenne especially, because they hustle so hard. Those things are feral. I did the launch last year for the Cayenne Turbo E Hybrid in Spain, and they had us like ripping around a little racetrack down in a quarry, which is usually used for motorcycles. Wow. And they're having us chase a 911 Turbo S in a 7,000-pound, 715 or whatever horsepower SUV. Like I've never seen carbon ceramic brakes smoke before, but they definitely did after this.
Incredible.
It's just like what the engineers there are able to do. And now with like more increasingly with sort of like parts, right? Like that 4-liter V8 is they share it between, you know, Audi and Bentley and whatever, but it feels unique and it feels special in the Porsche, and you don't feel like you're kind of, you know, getting a dime a dozen powertrain. It's, yeah, the whole thing is just, it's incredible to me, like how they have it dialed.
I think that, like, on the value front, again, the you know, I'm sure there are plenty of people out there who have leased like a Macan and a Cayenne specifically, not to pick on those, again, like perfectly great, actually, like very lovely to drive, to your point, SUVs, if that's your thing. But, you know, kind of like lease them and had them be more or less a commodity car with the cool badge. I doubt very much anybody buying even a Panamera, which is not, again, like not the sports model, but it's really special. Anybody buying, and especially like specking to their liking, these models are ever like filled with regret once they get the car. Right. I think it's something that you're getting that you're really excited about. It's a sort of dream that you've always wanted to have, or it's like a continuation of your Porsche thing and you're excited to have the new one too. So
for sure.
I do think that they make good on, I think that they make happy customers out of all that money that they're making too. And there's something to be said for that as well. So
yeah, like I'm a Porsche fanatic, obviously. Yeah. Like, you know, I wanted a 911 my whole life and all this stuff, but like I try to stay as sort of, as we all do, I think, kind of agnostic about stuff as possible when we're driving new cars. I've never been disappointed getting into a new Porsche. Like, it's always been like, the experience to me has always been better than what I think it's going to be. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's going in with a fairly high opinion, and that's hard to do. I mean, there are other cars that are, you know, like legendary performance brands or whatever, and I'll get it and I'm like, well, I don't know, where's that all that money going, is this,
yeah, weird?
But I never end up feeling like that with, you know, with the Porsche stuff. So, yeah.
Good stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, I also have a new car this week. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more. For sure, we'll throw some stuff up on social. Just I'm driving a very interesting BMW X2 M35i that we were talking about a lot. I'm not prepared. I don't have photos and stuff ready to go to talk about on the show. So check out CarID _com on Instagram or whatever social platform you prefer, because we're going to put some, I did some quick reels and some photos and stuff there of that. What I've really been driving this week, though, you guys, is my new car, which is also my new project car, my new personal car, a brand spanking new 2011 Subaru WRX hatchback or wagon. Impreza WRX wagon, I believe, in that third generation. For some reason, thinking that the hatchback moniker was going to sink the sales proposition for the Subaru WRX. But let me pull it up. Oh, sorry. I've got to share here. So let me do this. So yeah, I got the car last weekend. It's only been about a week. And I'm really digging it. It's so, just to like kind of go over the basics, like, this is a, like I said, 2011. The car has about 113,000 miles on it, I think, right now. The previous owner had it for 7 or 8 years. So he's had it for most of its life and did a lot of the stuff that I was concerned with when I started looking for hatchbacks. I was, you know, like some of the big ticket items at around the 100,000 mile mark, where almost all of them are, that I saw anyways, are what you'd expect. Timing belt, water pump, all the ancillary stuff that goes along with that. Two clutches should have been replaced maybe twice at that point or something like that. And this guy had done almost all of that stuff too. More importantly, I think for me, he didn't do much else. Like, the car has got a strut brace. It's got, I should have had the list in front of me, but it's basically got some like handling additions to it. The biggest thing that's really noticed, the two biggest things that I've noticed a lot of are, he put the STI, he put the STI steering rack in it, and a flat bottom steering wheel that he had made by somebody who makes WRX steering wheels. And then there's a short throw shift kit and stiffer shift bushings in it by a company, I think, called Carboy. So it really is like a super short throw shifter, which honestly, I didn't think that I was going to love. I like both those things quite a lot, right? It's been literally since this generation was new, since I've been in a third gen WRX of any kind, I don't remember it feeling especially sloppy, but either in terms of steering or shifting when I drove it. But I do know that it wasn't, you know, it, it, there was some play, right? Like it was not the most accurate like steering rack in the world. So I think that both of those things make sense for the car so far. And there's also an exhaust on it. I think he's got a Cobb catback exhaust. I have a Cobb catback exhaust on it, which is medium loud. It really annoyed me at first when I had that experience when I first drove it home of thinking, you know, test drive was awesome. Loved the car, felt great. Like pre-purchase inspection came back great. I was really excited about it. Went, handed him the money for the car, got in it, drove it home, which is a long highway drive for me. And I was like, shit, this thing is loud. Like it was groaning on the highway. There's just like, when you're used to driving new cars, especially, like there's just so much more mechanical noise happening, like in a car, one, an old WRX, and two, just an old car in general. Kyle, to your point about like the rattle trap-ness of this particular car, I was like, damn it, it was really hitting me. And then now I've had it for a week and I don't really notice it anymore, right? Like the droniness of the exhaust kind of fades away and you get used to it a little bit, and now it sounds more normal. So I've just been having a blast in it. The car is super fun. Like it has, I can't say this like with absolute authority, because I, again, like your memory just gets a little like soft around every particular version of a model of car when you've driven all of them. But I feel like this era of WRX and this era of that 2.5 liter, what's the engine code for this box? I should know that.
EJ something or other.
I think that's right. But there's a big turbo moment in this car. Like when was the last time you drove like a turbocharged car that had that, like the turbo is actually kicking in? So, you know, like when you're like revving up the car, when you're accelerating and you hit right around 3,600 RPMs, like the turbo spools up and you get like that whoosh of power. And I know that's not like the reason that we've changed to, you know, subtler and more efficient turbo technologies is essentially to smooth that out, to smooth out that torque curve, which is fantastic for daily driving and sort of dropping the torque peak down lower so that you don't feel it. But dude, it's so much fun too when you're just like hot on it and you feel the turbo kick in and it gets going. That's been super great. So overall, yeah, I'm just super pleased. I'm definitely still in the halo period with this little WRX and just like enjoying running it around town. And I've done a couple fun drives in it. So
I love turbo lag so much. I think it's so, so fun. I remember when I was in high school, I drove a Mazda Speed 6, and that is like the poster child for turbo lag.
Oh my God.
And it was just like so hilarious just how, like, if you're on it and if you like know what you're doing with the shifter, which I didn't then because I was in high school, but if you know what you're doing with the shifter, you can kind of work around the like true lag part of it. Mm-hmm. But even not really knowing how to use an engine's like power curve, it was still just so fun to like feel nothing, and then everything all at once. Like you feel it in your gut, and it's so much fun.
Like that 80s turbocharging kind of thing where it's, yeah, there's nobody at home because the motor's got like 7-to-1 compression, and then all of a sudden you're getting like shoved into hyperspace. That like I think it was like 2013-ish Mazda Speed 3 was the same way, where it's like,
yep,
you're like puttering along, and then all of a sudden you're blowing the wheels off because like all 300 horsepower, whatever it is, like came in.
Yeah.
They make like 20 less horsepower, like at each RPM than the regular Mazda 3 until you get to like 3000 RPM. But like around idle, you're literally making less power than you would in a standard Mazda 3. And it's so funny to me. Like I'm a fan. I like it. I think we should have called it, I think the early journalists should have called it Turbo Whoosh, and it wouldn't have ever gone away because people would have liked it instead of saying it was a bad thing.
Well, I mean, I haven't had that many experiences driving the older ones, because I think, like to your point, by the time we got to 2011 and early 2000s, like even with that Mazda, like that one was pretty dramatic, but they had figured it out more. The two that always stand out in my mind from when I was a kid are the, I can't remember the products that Dodge used in other than a weird Omni turbo, but they're the Dodge 2.2.
The Bomni.
That thing was bananas. Like it felt like a 1 liter diesel until the turbo hit, and then it was just like shredding the skin off your face, or so it felt in 1994 whenever I was driving it. And then the other one that I didn't drive in when it was a contemporary car, but I did for a vintage story years ago, was the Mercure XR4 Ti. Like,
oh yeah.
which was from the mid-80s or something like that. And that thing really was like an on and off switch. Everybody talks about the original 911 turbos, like the first and the second one specifically being death traps, because if that hit, the turbo hits mid-corner, if you're not really judging it, you can like throw the car totally out of whack. I believed it after driving that car. And that was, I mean, it was fun too, as long as you knew you're going in a straight line, or you knew when to expect it if you weren't, because if you're not, then you're actually kind of endangering yourself on a canyon road or something. This isn't that, but there's enough drama involved in it that I do think that it makes for a more involving experience. That said, Brett, there are definitely times when I've, like you said, I've forgotten, sort of just been cruising along through town in third gear and been like, oh, I have zero power at all because I'm not, I didn't downshift, and it's just not going to give it me any of the torques that I want to have. So
you got to keep it on boil, you know,
keep it on boil. Good thing that shifter falls readily to hand.
Yeah, what's the finely calibrated butt dyno saying?
A minimum of 267 horsepower as opposed to the 265 rated. That's probably the cat-back though, right?
Oh yeah.
It definitely, yeah, cat-back adds 3 to 4 horsepower. Your shift bushings probably add 3 to 4. If you add it all up, you're probably at like 290 or 300, honestly.
No, it doesn't. I mean, you know, I said this a bunch before, but in the era of electric vehicles, right? Like the ID4 has stronger acceleration, I'm sure, than the WRX does, right? Like any electric motor makes an older turbocharged engine feel slow. So you do have to be in the right mindset to like want to ring that out. There are plenty of other things that like make up for it in my mind as an enthusiast vehicle, but it still feels quick. Like it's 265 horsepower is plenty in just about any vehicle, I think, to feel fast around town and getting up to speed on the highway and things like that. So it's been super fun. I'm digging it.
Congratulations.
Very cool.
Thank you. Yeah. How many times?
About time.
Maybe my 14th. I don't know. We did the list before. 12th. I don't know. I'm in double digits of cars anyways. Maybe this is 12 or 13 or 14. Who can recall?
We need to get the car ID drive cylinder count going. We need to everyone needs to provide a list of all the cylinders that they've owned and do the cylinder count. Speaking of Peter Egan, he's the guy who introduced me to cylinder counts.
It's the first time that I've been all turbocharged in my personal fleet either. And I'm pretty sure that I can recall because Molly's got a Q5. That's a 2 liter turbo. And now we've got the 2.5 liter turbo as well. So
very nice.
Talk about long running turbo 4-cylinder engines. That EJ was around for like decades. The EA8 something, 888 or whatever it is. I think that's been around in some form or another for at least like a decade and a half. Like there's something to be said for a well sort of sorted drivetrain like that.
Yeah, absolutely. As long as you don't like nitrous it into a billion pieces.
Touche. Yeah, fair enough.
Well, so speaking of which, like we're a lot of people buy it. Certainly, like just about every WRX owner I found a warm welcome on the internet as a newly minted WRX owner. Let's put it that way. Some really enthusiastic people, really great community in real life too. Honestly, like there are lots of people around who will flash their lights and give you the Subaru peace sign thing, which is kind of fun, but. But the thing is, when you start to look, most of the people who buy these cars buy them to give them as many horsepower as possible, to take them to the track, to do kind of crazy things with them, which is awesome. Like, I really appreciate that. I don't think that's going to be my thing necessarily, but I like the fact that there's that enthusiasm and that kind of community around the car. But that got me thinking this week, you guys, like all of us have these project cars that we're working on, and I think that there are a million different ways that you can go with any different vehicle, right? So I thought it would be fun for us to go through and sort of talk a little bit about like the plan that we have. Like what would be the idealized version of the project car that you have in your garage right now? What are you working towards, right? And maybe the idea is just, because the honest answer for me is really just nothing. Like right now I'm happy to have it sit in the garage and I want to drive it for a while and sort of figure out what I want to do next. But as that starts to crystallize, you do have an idea of like, oh, I always saw one of whatever it is. I always saw one that I liked that was this way, that looked this way, or had this kind of performance, or did a different thing than mine is able to do now. And it's neat to be able to have that in mind and then build towards that with a project car. So I thought we could just go around the table and sort of talk about that. Like, what is the plan in a, again, everything else being equal in a perfect world for our project cars. So, all right. You want to start with the Lexus or?
You know, I actually am pretty satisfied with the Lexus, if I'm totally honest. It's the Z4 that's making me sad. And let me tell you why. I'm going to show you a picture that someone took of my car a long time ago. And
I gotta stop sharing, sorry.
Yeah, you're good. I got it. So this photo was taken by my friend Tyler Clementson. He's a great photographer. He works for Red Bull now, so he's done a lot of really cool stuff photography related. And I just want my car to be the car that Tyler Clementson's camera thinks it is, honestly. Like, that's my goal for the Z4, is just to... It, like, this photo hides all of the flaws that this car has, and it just makes me, like, so happy to see it in photos and then kind of sad to see it in real life. So I just want to get it to that nice, shiny gleaming. And then the other thing that I want to do to it, ignore the price because I didn't pay that for my seats, but check these out. And this is the other thing that I want to do to my car. We are right. There we are. So this is a set of the M Sport seats. It came in the Z4M, and they're so much better than the seats that my car came with. I found a set for really cheap. I think I bought them for $500, and they need a little work. And then they need to be re-dyed or reupholstered in this red to match the rest of the car. But that's kind of what I'm going to go with. So I'm going to do that black and red color scheme still. Hopefully with a little bit more shine in the paint and a little less flaws, so that it can truly live up to the view that I saw on that mountain road the other year.
So for those of you that might be listening and not watching, that's okay. Those are the they're not fixed. They're manually adjustable, heavily bolstered, side bolstered, like top and what do you call the high bolsters? I'm running out of technical terms.
Shoulder bolsters.
Yeah. You got like big shoulder bolsters and a fixed headrest, and just really, really so much more comfortable. I have them in my car currently. They're just they're brown and they don't match, but they're so much more comfortable than the seats that the standard Z4 came with. So just way better in every respect. And then I just want to get them red so that they match the rest of the car. And so I kind of have that cool black and red thing going on that I had before. And then just get the car spruced up and looking shiny. So that's kind of the vision that I have. It's kind of this OEM plus vibe. We'll get into it in a minute when we talk about some of our dream builders. But I just really love like keeping things relatively stock, kind of just taking the best from a manufacturer's portfolio and compiling it into one vehicle. So, you know, you've got great handling from this car, great steering wheel from this car, great seats from this car, and then the roadster body style from the Z4 that I just love. So that's kind of what I'm going for with this one. Just the OEM plus, a little bit better than it was when it came from the factory.
Nice. Cool. BMW Ty's the man, by the way.
Yeah, Tyler's great. Awesome dude. Great photographer. Cool dude. Very willing to do interesting, fun things. He's an aerial photographer now. He's like going up in airplanes and taking photos of like Red Bull's aerial stunt team. And it's just crazy seeing him do like go from cars and stuff like that to doing like golf and aerial photography. Cool dude. Tyler Clementson on Instagram. Go find him.
Awesome. Kyle, what's your vision? Are we talking about 911 now, or are we talking about X5?
911, the vision for the X5 is for it to be gone. so I feel like showing an empty driveway would be sad. But yeah, so we're talking about the 911. So I've had the car for like a year and a half now. And I've done a lot to it to kind of like make it mine, right? But it's a basic silver, like Arctic silver over black 911. It's basically invisible. And I've always loved like this color, which is a classic Porsche color called Bahama Yellow. Mm-hmm. It's like a kind of a very gold, almost tan-ish yellow color. And I want my car to be that color so badly. Yeah, it's just, it's rad. Like it's yellow without being like Crayola colored. And it's great. So that's like probably the biggest, most expensive thing that I would love to do eventually. I've also never had a car painted.
Nor have I.
So like that experience would be interesting. And I imagine painful. But, you know, and then like the next thing, if let's see here. So my car is cool. It was spec'd with the highly desirable factory hardback sport seats, but they're not that comfortable. Like they're not built for a man my size. Yeah. So my plans, and this is probably not super distant future, my plans are to pull those sport seats and sell them. I can probably get $2,000 or $3,000 out of them. And then I want to get these guys. Yeah, like they're, people really want them. And they're not that different from like the standard 996 seats, so I don't get it. But then I would replace them with these guys, the Traveler R from Schielmann. First of all, the centers are corduroy, so...
Wow.
Big grip energy there. But they're like, they're low, they sit lower. The bolstering is a little bit more ergonomic. They, you know, they still have all the tilt stuff, which I need because, you know, two door. They even have built in seat heaters, which is great. So I can get that to work with my factory heated seats, switches and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that'd be great. I mean, again, like one of those key sort of touch points in your car is the seat. And if you're not like planted and like comfortable, like you never really start to trust the car, you know.
Sure.
And that's kind of where I'm at with mine. And
these sheets seats from Schielmann yet, Kyle? Have you ever been in a car with them?
I have not yet, and I want to. They actually have their U.S. Sort of, they're German, obviously.
Yeah.
Their U.S. subsidiaries up in Portland. So at some point, I need to go back and visit family friends up there, and I'll probably swing by and try them out. But a couple of people, like I think Mike Burrows had a set in one of his cars from Stanceworks, who we'll talk a little bit more later. Mm-hmm. And then like Brian Scotto from Hoonigan, I know, put a set in his like big off-road church van thing that he has, and like they're both extremely complimentary of them. And Scotto's a huge dude, so. You know,
we thought about putting these in the Lexus, in the LX450, because they are a really common Land Cruiser 80 series mod, and they look amazing. We decided against it just because we don't need to go that hard on that thing, but they look great.
They're expensive because seats, but I think they're like $1,600 a piece, which, I mean, for considering like, you know, fully adjustable and heated and stuff like that, it's really not crazy. You can get it with armrests if you want too, which obviously I don't need for my car, but
the lap of luxury. But dude, if you're recouping, you know, like call it 70% to 90% of that,
yeah, totally,
like with the sale of your existing seats, then that makes it a lot easier to swallow too.
I'm
so curious about this because I've never done it, like, and I obviously I've sat in models of car that have different kinds of seats that are available from the factory. And I know that like they can fit you wild, in really different ways, right? Kyle and I are both really tall, so we've experienced this a lot. Depending on your width and your leg length and your torso length and stuff, different seats can feel really different. So I feel like buying seats without having tried them in my vehicle would be a little bit like buying pants on the internet, right? Like you have a general idea that they're going to fit,
right,
but not precisely how they're going to look when you actually put them on and look in the mirror, right?
Yeah, I think the other thing too, like, and this is a problem, the height thing, obviously, but a lot of my height's in my torso, so I always end up running out of headroom, much more than legroom. And so getting these on lower seat brackets or rails or whatever, like, that'd be huge, you know, like being able to more comfortably sit in the car and not, like, you know, smack my head on the roof when I go over a big freeway dip or something like that. The last thing that's sort of big is I need a new steering wheel. And this is another tall guy thing. The stock steering wheel in 911 is like 380 mil or something. And the 996 has a telescoping wheel, but it doesn't tilt. I run, I have very little room for my right leg. So there's like a lot of like steering wheel shuffling when I'm driving. And this is like a dream steering wheel. The guy that's selling this wants like $3,300 for it because it's super rare, Porsche design. I will not be getting this unless I, you know, win the lottery, which, you know. I do need a new steering wheel, and I'm feel weird about like ditching the airbag. I've never done that before, but I feel like being comfortable and confident in a car is probably going to help avoid a crash. So.
It's easy to say, but if you're not commuting in it, I would be more okay with like having easier control of the car and giving up like the reoccurrence of the airbag. But
I work from home, so I'm not, I don't do big commutes. And most of the time, if I'm driving the car, I'm driving it pretty hard. So something like this makes sense. And then I know like there's like a lot of weirdness to like go through to like make the airbag light not come on. And that's important to me because I hate lights. I hate like, you know, like workaround hack stuff.
Yeah.
And so that'll be a challenge. But yeah, that's it. I don't need a ton for my 911, but you know, more comfort and a little bit of extra style. And yeah.
I mean, again, this is just kind of these like little tweaks that they cost $6,000 in combined, but little tweaks that that kind of just like make it easier to use on a daily basis, just like that much better. You're not talking about a turbo kit. You're not talking about crazy suspension. You just literally want to make it more comfortable and easier to drive. Nothing wrong with that.
I mean, I already have the suspension. like one of my like COVID purchases for myself, when I saw my 401 tanking, I emptied it out and I bought a Rolex, which was great because I then made like $3,000 or $4,000 on it.
Nice.
And I used that to buy a set of Ohlins coilovers for the car, which I like a lot more than I liked my Rolex. And I like my Rolex a lot. And then, yeah, the other big one for like daily use is I've got the Porsche Classic Communication Management thing, which I think I've talked about before, where it's like a full-on touchscreen infotainment thing, but it's factory. So like it's got like the right color LED backlighting, and it's almost identical to the system that's in the 718 Boxster and Cayman right now, like the base system. But yeah, between like those things, it feels like a new car. That and good tires. But yeah, so it really, really kind of trying to make it my car without changing the character of it has been a big sort of the big goal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very nice.
I would love to drive that car, both of them, actually.
You're welcome to.
As modified. But so right now, again, and I hit this a little bit at the top, like I don't really know, like the vision, like the goal for the WRX, I think is a little unclear at this point. But one thing that I think would be fun to do, and it would definitely like fit my history and my vibe overall, is just the idea of the opposite of what everybody else does with an old WRX, which would be put it 100% back to stock, right? And again, like I said, it's not like a lot of things have been done to modify the car. There are not a lot of things that are difficult to undo. I haven't gone down the path of exploring how difficult it would be to get, you know, all of the factory stuff back. And I would resist going absolutely crazy. I have a great friend from high school whose dad was one of the first like serious car guys I ever met. And he was the kind of guy who had an MGA in boxes in his basement because he was waiting to get everything literally 100% original as it was sold new from MG before he put it back together. So wow. He didn't want a different, like an aftermarket wiring harness. He didn't want an unoriginal battery, right? Like he wanted the lug nuts to be original. And I think that's admirable and it's really cool. I don't know that the cost and kind of heartburn that are required to do that are for WRX, a 2011 WRX makes sense. But that being said, I loved this car when it was new. I drove this model of WRX when it was new. I thought it was great. And I think it would be a really interesting experiment to say, also, you know, I was texting about this idea with a friend and he was like, well, you would have like the only one left essentially, right? It is still very difficult to find these, even though they're, you know, a decade old or a little bit more, to find them in completely original form. So that would be something, I think that would be a fun challenge. It would sort of throw the idea of again, like Subaru enthusiasm on its head a little bit. And I think it would be a fun one to sort of track. You can see, I just pulled up an old press photo from the launch event for this vehicle. And my car is sort of in the spec that they had these WRX hatches at the launch event, same color, the same slate gray color, the same wheels and all that stuff. And it was cool. So Kyle, to your point about the wheel, the one thing that now I'm wondering whether I would keep is the flat bottom steering wheel that's in my car, because this the steering wheel does tilt, but it's still really low for me. Like,
right.
So with the flat bottom, it's just enough clearance that I feel really comfortable. It doesn't, my hands aren't like hitting my thighs or my knees and that thing that can be a little bit weird in some steering wheel positions, some hand positions. And I think that that would not be the case if I went back to the standard stock wheel. I think it would be just big enough that I would bump into my own legs a little bit. So that might be the one caveat if I went this route to the changes that have been made. But otherwise, I think that could be kind of fun.
I mean, like if you were going to sell the car or something, you pick up an original steering wheel and send it with the car or something.
I have the original wheel. Luckily, the guy who did everything like kept every part. Right.
I love that.
Very cool.
Really, really good dude, Lucas. Good. Appreciate you for all the hard work that you've put into this car.
I wonder if you could like backdate a 2000 Bug Eyes WRX wheel. I wonder if you could put one of those on, because I think those are pretty. It's like a Momo wheel. It's like relatively compact.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if you could like if it would like even fit on the steering shaft, or if it would play nice with the airbag module or whatever.
I bet it would. I mean, Subaru is like Lego, right?
Yeah, I can't imagine it was that like the components were like that wildly different even from one generation to the next. And remember, they changed and they still have like what WRX generations go real fast, right? So it's a couple of years between the two. I don't think that they really had the time or the investment in the engineering to change everything that dramatically. So that's a good idea too. All right. So beyond that, and I guess we can move into the next topic too. I wanted to, you know, we have been internally, as the team responsible for bringing Car ID Drive to you, we've been focused a lot on finding really interesting owners, finding really interesting people who are building cars and are modifying cars, right? Who are inspirational to us, because we think that they're going to be inspirational to you too. So as a way to wrap up today, since we've been talking about Project Cars, I thought it would be really fun to talk about some vehicle types or some specific builds or some builders that we find really inspirational as well. So Kyle, I know that you had a ton of them. Were you able to narrow it down to the top sort of two for
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I was.
Lay it on us.
Well, so the first one, you know, I interviewed him a month ago and we, you know, he's going hard on Reddit right now. Check it out. Is Mike Burrows from Stanceworks.
Yeah.
That guy is, first of all, he's got like the work ethic of like a plow horse, or he's just like he's like 7 days a week, goes in, works on the car, like goes home, goes back. Like that's not for me, but like I like that he does it. and again, mostly I think it's sort of his commitment to do his car his way. You know, like when he first announced like that he was gonna rip the Ferrari engine out of his 308, like everybody was, you know, the internet was lit up. The people were livid. But ultimately he's like, it's my car. I don't care. Like I'm doing it. And then what he ended up making sort of this out of this vision is incredible. Like it's there's nothing else like it. You know, it's a total labor of love. He had to like learn a bunch of skills to do it. Yeah, I mean it's rad. Like he's also just a really nice human being. Like, and that can't be, you can't discount that. I think, you know. So big thumbs up, big shout out to Mike Burrows. And then so my other sort of inspiration builder isn't a car builder. He's a guy I've met a few times in downtown LA. Especially when I was doing some work at the Peterson Museum, but his name's Max Hazen, and he is arguably one of the most incredible artist fabricator guys I've ever seen. Like the work that he does is unparalleled. It's all by hand. It's all in this little tiny shop on like the third floor of a crappy warehouse building in downtown LA. He's like, you know, taking an engine from like the 1950s, throwing a supercharger on it, custom building a frame and like, you know, these giant fenders, and they're just, every detail is perfect. Like everything is exquisitely done, and it's all just like him doing it by hand. And again, like there was a matter of like him learning this craft, learning this trade, and like to have that kind of singular clarity of vision and like the willingness to sort of push an envelope like that is, for me, somebody that's like generally pretty restrained when it comes to like car mods and doing stuff like that, is super inspirational. And also just a really, really nice dude.
So quickly, Kyle, again, for people who are maybe listening after the video, like we are talking about, Mike Hazen is doing all motorcycles. Is that right? Or
yeah. He's only motorcycles. Yep. He like, you know, most of them are barely rideable. It's really like, really like sort of art pieces. So, you know, there's again, like incredibly beautiful handcrafted, like fully from stock, like wheels and frames and handlebars and seats and stuff. And like, you know, the engines will come from, he built one with the engine from like a Vincent Black Shadow, I think, which is in and of itself like a $60,000 motorcycle engine.
Yeah.
I think he found it like a box of parts and like put it together. You know, there's stuff like that. And, you know, he's just this one dude doing it by himself, you know, and, again, like super, super humble, super thoughtful guy. And honestly, like it's almost superhuman, like the kind of stuff he's doing in that little shop.
This is incredible. So I don't have the vocabulary to describe, like, I think you're right. Like, cause this doesn't really, the words I'm going to use are incomplete. Right. But it's sort of like a, like almost a bobber idea, but like rendered in, a completely different art form. I think they're really incredible. I encourage everybody to, I can't see it right now, but maybe somebody can read out his actual Instagram handle, but to check out his Instagram page.
Yeah, it's just Maxwell Hazen, MaxwellHazan on Instagram.
These are really, really super cool. And I think one thing, because I'm not a motorcycle guy, like I rode dirt bikes when I was a kid and then it kind of ended there. But I always have really appreciated, especially like the super high end custom motorcycles, because unlike, I mean, my heart is always with things on four wheels and with cars because I can experience them in a different way. But on a motorcycle, like everything is there. It's all on display, right? Like every piece of it, every piece of the machine can be made available for you to look at it as well as experience while you're riding it, right? And I think that there's something there that I like about watches that like falls into that too, where you're like, it's this smaller machine, it's very intimate. And in this case, like every piece has been really well considered, it seems. Just lots of finishing work and crazy detail in something that does not have to be particularly well detailed to be functional. Like I appreciate all of that. Even I'm just being introduced right now, but you can just tell that there's a tremendous amount of consideration in everything that you're looking at.
That's what I love about motorcycle building is like, especially in modern automobiles, like you pop the hood of a modern car and there's a big plastic cover on the engine and it's kind of designed to be interesting and blah, 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 but it's not actually the engine. With a motorcycle, my motorcycle is not a great example because the engine is kind of just thrown in there and there's wiring everywhere. This guy is like literally considering every single piece. And it's that amount of detail is crazy to me that he's making tiny little bits and bobs on the engine, making sure that they're perfectly polished and perfectly matching the aesthetic. It's awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, he's like hand producing everything. Like, you know, if you see something that's like the triple tree, the clamp that holds the handlebars and stuff, he's sitting there on a milling machine in a lathe, like, you know, like eyeballing it, kind of just, it's, yeah, again, it's just unreal. And sort of to that point, I love motorcycles in general. I'm building one, not to the standard, obviously. but I like the clarity of sort of purpose. Like there's no room for things that don't need to be there, you know, like in most cases, like everything has a function. Like you have to have two wheels, you have to have an engine, like the frame has to support you and the engine and the there's these engineering concerns. And I mean, for Max, again, like most of his stuff is not, they're like museum pieces, like they're not going to get ridden a lot, but you know, like this, again, it's there, it's all there, like you can fire them up and ride them and stuff. And that's really cool and really difficult to do, I think.
I love it. So maybe in the same vibe, I'll go next because I want to talk about Singer. I think Singer's been talked about a lot. Singer Vehicle Design, founded by Rob Dickinson, has been around for quite a while now. They've been doing some insanely high end, what do they call them? Reimagined by, right? Yeah. So like old 911s that have been like, you know, basically like thoroughly redone, in everywhere, like better performance across the board, like incredible finishing. But the thing that has always struck me, and this is the real inspirational part for me, is if Brett, if you find or can stick on any photos from the interiors, right? There's so many cars that I've loved driving and that I've owned over the years. This thought really hit home when I had my E46 ZHP, my coupe, right? Amazing car. Like, there was really nothing that I wanted to change about the way that the car drove. Like, it had plenty of power. I loved the way that it handled. It was really analog. I just dug it, right? The problem with the car, I mean, and there are cosmetic issues with the outside that could be fixed too. But what I really wanted was, I thought, this car, like a 911, in my mind, deserves to like be treated lavishly, to have like a truly like world-class environment to drive it in, right? So why aren't there people like the people at Singer who are doing this, who for customers, and I'm sure that they exist. So first of all, for those of you out there that are doing this work, like reach out to us. If you hear the podcast or watch the podcast, let us know. We'd love to talk about your work or see your stuff. But at the time, you know, and now obviously talking a lot about WRX, like I think that there are so many amazing, fantastic Japanese cars out there. I think that there are that are from the 80s and 90s and 2000s. I think that we've all talked a lot about like cars that we love that are really affordable right now that are from 20 years old or something like that. Doing something like what Singer is doing with both interior design, their material quality, they just like amazing work in the detailing with metalwork and fabric, color selection and all that stuff. Doing something like that in an E46 sounds ridiculous because we're talking about like a $10,000 car or an $8,000 car, even on the some of the more performance-oriented models, right? And these are million-dollar Porsches that mm-hmm. will probably continue to be worth $1 million. But I think that there's something there because I think people care enough about them. And I think that there's enough inherent value in the vehicle, like when it's the way that it's screwed together and goes down the road, that it deserves to, at least for a few of them, to get treated to this kind of craftsmanship and work inside it. So I don't know exactly where to go with that yet, but I've always thought that would be so cool to have even a rather like beat up looking old, you know, like WRX that had this like wild $80,000 interior on the inside. I just think so, there's something about that that really speaks to me. Yeah. I think it'd be really, really fun to do. Yeah, is this the
this is the Pro Drive.
The Pro Drive, right. This is kind of the opposite. The Pro Drive, the interior is more or less pickup from the existing car, from the existing 22, well, not 22B, but STI.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
It's which is also cool. I mean, that's not totally fair. They have new seats and new infotainment. But when I drove this car at Goodwood Festival of Speed 2 years ago, and I'll tell you that everything that feels special about the car is under the hood and behind the wheels. And the interior feels fine. It's cool, but it feels like a nice version of like a well done SEMA car or something, like a really well done resto mod. It doesn't feel special in the way that like Singer makes you feel special when you're inside the view, or Icon, or you know, name a few of these other brands that do these incredibly high end resto mods of iconic vehicles and really lavish a lot of attention on that. I think that there's a lot to be said for that. But
Icon's a really good example of that because Jonathan Ward is a maniac, especially like the derelict cars where they're just sort of one offs. I've been really lucky to drive a couple of them, and again, like the level of detail that he goes into for these things to make them look more or less like stock plus is unreal. Like you spend time in it, you can see why they're like $500,000 to $600,000, you know, and they take 3 or 4 years to build. Like it's I really appreciate that same kind of attention to detail. And like when Rob Dickinson started doing Singer, everybody thought he was a maniac. Like, what? Nobody's going to pay that much for a 911. Are you stupid? And obviously he proved everybody wrong.
Well, they were also half the price at that point too, right? They slowly
like $500,000.
Yeah, crept up to the $1 million mark. And I think like, you know, they're probably putting a lot more time and money into those cars as well too. I don't know what is worth $1 million at this point, but I can tell you that if I had $1 million to spend on a car, that would be very high on my list of things that I would like to own. So
for sure. Shout out to Rob Dickinson of the Catherine Wheel, and also relative of Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden.
Beautiful.
We got to bring it back somehow, you know?
Always, yeah. All right, Brett, what's your inspiration?
Well, so mine is a little less aspirational, I suppose. But my buddy has just a very, very cool, I'll show you here. He's a very cool BMW ZHP 330i. And this is another one of these like OEM plus builds where he's kind of just like, as things pop up, he handles them. He kind of just takes care of it. Doesn't let anything go. This is just his car at a car show. I'm going to show you a few more pictures and I want you to try and guess. He did a sizzle reel for his old work or for his job. So he's got these cool, awesome photos, this beautiful, titanium silver 330i. And I just want you to guess what kind of mileage you think it has on it.
Well, number one, can I just say that this was the color of my ZHP. I had the same, yeah. I had the coupe, not the four door. The paint quality on that car looks insane. That looks incredible. I don't know if he's had it like resprayed or redone it, or if it's just like.
Hasn't been resprayed yet. It's just been pretty well maintained and he does pretty good, you know, with like washing and waxing and stuff like that. So yeah, I think it's one side of it has been resprayed because it got keyed all the way down. But the rest of the car, most of the panels are very, very factory original. He bought it with 90,000 miles 5 or 6 years ago. And I just want you to guess what mileage it has on it now.
180.
I'll go under. I'll go 150.
282,000 miles on this car.
Wow. Excellent. That's impressive to drive that many in that time.
Well, that's the thing is like, it's not a garage. So here it was when it had 270 and that was a year ago. And he drives it everywhere. He goes all over creation with this car. And it's mental. It's just, he's kept it so well. And so I really admire that. Like, first of all, that it's just in such good condition already, but then also just that it's been maintained in like relatively like OEM style condition. And just to, you know, just so that you know, I just want to show you one more photo so that you know it's not a complete garage queen. It does actually get used pretty regularly. We took it out to El Mirage a couple of years ago and just like tromped on it, just absolutely hooned this thing to within an inch of its life, and it still is just in great shape. So that's kind of the inspiration. And then I also would be remiss not to bring it back home a little bit and mention this guy. So this is my other half, Noah, and he is insane and very detail oriented when it comes to his cars. He just bought a second Mini Cooper, he kind of just again like takes. He has like a book, like a electronic copy of the Mini accessories, the original Mini accessories from 2005, 2006, and he just like flips through and he's like, I'm gonna get the driving lights for my car, and he buys the 2006 era driving lights and these like grill badges that you could get for your car back in the day. He buys the grill badges and puts them on. So just again, just this like very granular attention to detail that with my poorly maintained, neglected vehicle, like I really aspire to that kind of mentality of just keeping things nice and taking care of things as they pop up and making sure the car never gets as derelict as mine has.
Josh CBT is impressed by both either the ZHP or the Mini, or it looks like maybe both of them. So Josh, thanks for watching. But
why not? Yeah.
Brett, when I saw that photo on Instagram that Noah has did the red box. That's incredible. And I've got a new, you're gonna be mad at me because I've got a new obsession for him. If he hasn't already thought of this yet.
Uh-oh.
One of my favorite things in the world is, and everybody likes this, like I love old magazines. I love old advertising in old magazines. And this, I believe, is from the first run of at least when Mini relaunched as a brand. I think globally they did this thing with the red frame, right? In around the launch window for the US, which was slightly after when BMW bought the brand and they brought it back out in the UK and Europe. They were doing some of the most incredible, like in mag advertising that was like trifolds, quadfolds, like big things that came out, games. There were cars that punched out. There was all this like interactive advertising collateral that was, this is the same campaign stuff. I don't know the agency that did it. We should really track this down. This would be a fun story. But But finding those books, those magazines that have the original ads in them with all the different, like if you could get some sort of database of all the all the collateral that they created, that stuff would be, it's just like amazing ephemera. Because everybody either didn't pay any attention to it or popped it out and like played with it. They folded up the paper car and had it on their desk and then it got thrown away when they moved or, the or whatever. That stuff is really, really cool. And I think if Noah is getting like deep, deep in the weeds of the mini stuff, he seems like the type of person that would appreciate that a lot.
I remember when that campaign was going on, there was like a, it was like a sticker book. There was like a base mini, and then you could like peel and stick different wheels. They even like, it was like factory options for sure. But then they also had like Daniel Boone flags for the antenna. And you could put like fuzzy dice hanging from the mirror and stuff like that. Like it's just, it's mental. The amount of detail that that ad campaign and the sheer amount of cost. It wasn't just like print on a page. It was literally like tear outs and fold ups and stuff like that. It was crazy. The amount of energy that Mini and BMW put into this car's relaunch. And that's probably why it became such an icon when all the other retro cars kind of died off.
There was a sticker page that you could get that had bogey stickers that you could put on your car of different car models that you beat somehow, but
And don't forget the Italian Job remake, which fully cemented these cars. Like,
did you know that only one of the cars in the Italian Job remake is an S?
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Charlize Theron drove the S, and the other two just drove like highly tuned standard cars.
That's like finding out in the, that the M5 and the final chase in Ronin was actually just like a 535. And
yeah.
And you can't go back and live in the time before you knew that, and everything's bad.
You think they're going to... Well, I guess the E34 M5 wasn't that valuable then, so it wouldn't have been totally out of pocket for them to destroy a real one.
Plus, John Frankenheimer's got money. What's he... You know. R.I.P. But, yeah. That ZHP was amazing, but man, what a like a ship of Theseus that thing has to be at this point. Like,
oh my God. Yeah.
Like knowing old BMW life, like, wow, there's a lot of spare parts in that thing.
I'm trying to think what he's had to do major. So like it's had a couple clutches, I know. But the engine's intact. The engine hasn't been apart completely. The DESA valves have been replaced, the Vanos has been updated, but you know, like by and large, it's actually been decently. I think part of it is like it's getting used regularly. So much of things that happen to old BMWs happen because they sit, and this one's getting used pretty regularly. The rubber and the plastic are all staying like relatively like moist and not drying out and cracking. I think that's a big part of it, but it's definitely been through a lot. Like the subframe had to get reinforced and welded a couple of years ago, and that was a big deal. But definitely been through a lot, but still
At a minimum, he should rest easy knowing that he decides to move on from the car around 300,000 miles, certainly one of the three people hosting this podcast today is willing to buy it from him, I'm sure.
Yeah.
probably there'll be a bidding war. All right, y'all, listen, this has been super fun. Really fun topic. Thank you everybody for watching. As ever, you guys, if you're watching this on YouTube, please like and subscribe to the channel. Leave us a comment if you're watching this after the fact. We would love to go back and answer that. And if you're somebody who's into listening to the podcast, just the audio version, or you don't always have time to watch the video, you can find us on all the normal audio streaming platforms, iTunes, whatever the Android one is, Stitcher, Spotify, like all of those big ones, we're available all there too. So check us out, subscribe, leave a comment, rating, anything that we can get will help us grow. Brett, Kyle, thank you so much. And we'll see you all next Wednesday.
Vaya con Dios.
Have a good one.